They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Welcome again to Necessary and Proper. This episode features an address by Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher from a June 6th luncheon we held at the Mayflower Hotel titled Founding Principles as Pillars of Our Foreign Policy. In it, the congressman reflects upon the views of the founders, discusses the current state of Congress, and makes the case that Wisconsin has had a particular impact on American foreign policy. This speech was followed by a panel discussion with Professor Henry Now, Ilya Shapiro, and Professor Jeremy Rabkin. You can listen to that part of the program in the next episode. As always, please let us know how we are doing at articlei@fedsoc.org.
Thank you. I believe it's also the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Belleau Wood, if I'm getting that correctly. So if there are any devil dogs out there, or Tuffelhunden, as they earn that name in that battle, Semper Fi. It's an honor to be here today with a group I so greatly admire. It's a privilege to talk about the founding. The founding obviously animates all of us. It gives us guidance in troubled times as we continually remind ourselves of that fateful day on August 11th, 1919, when Curly Lambeau used a $500 loan from the Indian Packing Company to found what would become the Green Bay Packers, the only NFL team where we, the people, everyday owners like me, are in charge. In fact, in my orientation for Congress, Bob Kraft, the owner of the Pats, addressed all of us, and I simply could not help myself. I went up to him afterwards, and I said, Mr. Kraft, it's just good to meet another NFL owner. You understand what I'm going through every day. But putting football aside, Wisconsin has much to contribute to the topic at hand, though that may not be obvious at first. America's Dairyland has a distinctly American foreign policy legacy that connects directly with our founding principles. And since I can't really tell this group anything you don't know about the Constitution or from a legal perspective, I'd instead like to offer a Wisconsin perspective on the framers' vision. I'd like to illustrate this tradition with three stories that together provide both snapshots of critical junctures in American history and timeless wisdom from the earliest days of our republic. The first lesson is about the role of Congress in American foreign policy. This year, we celebrate the centennial of the end of World War I, and Wisconsin was in many ways a very reluctant participant in the Great War. You see, Wisconsin, 30% of its population was German-American, and anti-war socialists and progressive Republicans were ascendant. Indeed, our state's most prominent politician then or since, Senator Bob La Follette, was doggedly committed to a policy of strict neutrality, a policy that Wilson himself had campaigned for re-election on. In fact, while filibustering Wilson's bill to arm merchant vessels on the Senate floor, fighting Bob La Follette almost got into an actual fight on the Senate floor, and there were rumors that someone had brought a gun and he was going to shoot him, and he called his son to bring a bag which had a gun in it, and it's a fascinating history. But a month later, on April 4th, 1917, and La Follette was successful in the filibuster, but a month later, during a special session of Congress, Bob burst into tears on the Senate floor while arguing for 4 hours against President Woodrow Wilson's call to enter the war. La Follette began this speech by asserting that all Americans, including Congress, have a responsibility to approach presidential leadership critically, rather than merely, quote, standing back of the president without inquiring whether the president is right or wrong. He demanded a popular vote on entry into the war, and as he put it, quote, this war is being forced upon our people without their knowing why and without their approval. He criticized the emerging coercive wartime laws in the United States, including the espionage bills, the conscription bills, and other forcible military measures which we understand, and this is him talking, are being ground out of the war machine in this country. Now, La Follette got a lot of things wrong, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room would criticize the progressive movement then and presently. But his basic points that we can't give the president a blank check, that wars, particularly those with grandiose goals of making the world safe for democracy, shouldn't be entered into until all other options are exhausted. That strikes me as points that we should heed today. The importance of the legislature's role in national security was certainly not lost on the framers, who created, in my opinion, not co-equal branches, but rather a legislative leviathan. And that extends to matters of foreign policy. Even strong advocates of an energetic executive like Alexander Hamilton understood that Congress needed to play an important role in American foreign policy. In Federalist 75, Hamilton argues, quote, "The history of human conduct does not warrant that exalted opinion of human virtue, which would make it wise in a nation to commit interests of so delicate and momentous a kind as those which concern its intercourse with the rest of the world to the sole disposal of a magistrate created and circumstanced as would be the President of the United States." And I think it's safe to say that La Follette and probably even Hamilton would be distraught to learn that the United States has been at war now for 17 years while relying only on 60 words of authorization passed 3 days after September 11th. As former Senator Jim Webb convincingly argued in a great spring 2013 national interest article, since really the 1973 War Powers Resolution, Congress has abdicated much of its authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Or perhaps to paraphrase that great cinematic treatment of the Constitution, the 1999 movie Office Space, when it comes to foreign policy, the Congress hasn't quit. It's just decided that it's not going to go to work. Now, this presents a dilemma if you're a conservative internationalist. On the one hand, I'd like to see, and that was a shameless plug of Professor Now's book right there. On the one hand, I'd like to see a more active U.S. role in Syria, for example, in combating Iranian and Russian influence. On the other hand, the administration's argument that the president can unilaterally order strikes against a government in no way connected with either the 2001 or 2002 AUMFs, based merely on the national interest and the fact that hostilities were not anticipated to rise to the level of, quote, war in the constitutional sense, unquote, seems laughable to me, or lacking at best. I mean, there are about 200 dead Russian and Syrian mercenaries who would quibble with the fact that it didn't rise to the sense of war in the constitutional sense. At the very least, I think most of us would agree with what Fighting Bob La Follette said on October 6, 1917, after he had been viciously attacked as a traitor to the country, after they tried to use the espionage attack to prosecute him, after there was an effort to kick him out of the Senate for being a traitor. He argued on the Senate floor that, quote, "The right to control their own government according to constitutional forms is not one of the rights that the citizens of this country are called upon to surrender in times of war." And while I don't agree with Bob on everything, that strikes me as something that fits in the present day. The second lesson concerns the enduring reality of international competition and the need to see the world as it truly is. Never was this more important than in the early days of the Cold War, which Professor Rabkin and I were talking about. As the Grand Alliance with the Soviet Union gradually gave way to a long-term strategic competition that was to define the second half of the 20th century. While it may appear obvious in hindsight that America and the Soviets were destined for competition over post-war Europe, at the time, many in the West, including in the U.S. government, were deluding themselves over Soviet intentions. One man who harbored no such illusions was Milwaukee's own native son, George Frost Kennan, who by the end of the Second World War had already gained a reputation as one of the State Department's foremost Soviet hands. In early 1945, Kennan was warning that the Soviet Union would seek to expand westwards and, quote, "will never find a place short of the Atlantic Ocean where it can, from its own standpoint, safely stop." But while Kennan was seeing the world clearly, the American government was at times dangerously naive. Following a frosty turn in relations with the Soviets after Yalta, President Truman convinced himself that Stalin's subordinates were responsible for the downturn, not the Soviet dictator himself, leading to Potsdam, a summit which Kennan viewed as so unproductive that he, not for the first time, attempted to tender his resignation from the Foreign Service. Later in 1945, seeking to deepen engagement with the Soviets, Secretary of State James Burns unilaterally decided to go to Moscow in December for a foreign ministers conference and promptly got taken to the diplomatic cleaners. The Moscow negotiations drove Kennan crazy. As Gaddis writes in his fantastic biography of Kennan, Kennan felt the talk served only to revive the pretense of common interests and to paper over still more cracks. And after a major speech from Stalin, the State Department asked for Kennan's analysis, and he was all too happy to burden the telegraphic channel with his reply. In what would become known as the Long Telegram, Kennan set about the task of convincing Washington to wake up from its post-war illusions and to see the Soviet Union as it truly was. In extraordinarily blunt terms, Kennan wrote, "We have here a political force committed fanatically to the belief that with the U.S. there can be no permanent modus vivendi, that it is desirable and necessary that the internal harmony of our society be disrupted, our traditional way of life be destroyed, and the international authority of our state be broken." As Gaddis writes, the Long Telegram became the conceptual foundation for the strategy the United States and Great Britain would follow for over four decades, with modest adjustments. The enduring reality of geopolitical competition and the cold logic of force was not something that was lost on the framers either. As Hamilton lays out in Federalist 24, though a wide ocean separates the United States from Europe, yet there are various considerations that warn us against an excess confidence in our security. Worse still, the territories of Britain, Spain, and of the Indian nations in our neighborhood encircle the Union from Maine to Georgia. And a future concert of views between these nations ought not to be regarded as improbable. This potential encirclement was particularly concerning given the European track record. In Federalist 11, Hamilton cautions, if we should not be willing to be exposed in a naked and defenseless condition to European insults or encroachments, we should find it expedient to increase our frontier garrisons. What Kennan and Hamilton, I believe, understood fully was that our little Lockean experiment exists in a Machiavellian world, one that routinely mocks the enduring lie that we can end all wars. Until men become angels, you can no sooner wean the world off oxygen, in my opinion. Even in a world made safe or safer for democracy, or a world in which freedom was on the march rather than in retreat from rising forces of authoritarianism, we would still face threats from rogue states, tyrants, and terrorists. And to the extent this lie serves, as it has in various points in our country's history, as an excuse for inaction, it is dangerous. Because as Machiavelli pointed out, war cannot be avoided. It can only be postponed to the other's advantage. In the Midwest, we might say more simply, problems don't age well. You must tackle them quickly before they devolve into major crises. This is a lesson that I believe is reflected in the recent national security and national defense strategy, which I believe show that the U.S. government is slowly, very slowly, waking up to the challenges posed by long-term strategic competition with Russia and China. What I believe will be a generational challenge on par with the Cold War. There's still so much that must be done, and we're only just beginning to think through the implications, but in starting, we could do a lot worse than keeping in mind Kennan's observation that you have no idea how much it contributes to the general politeness and pleasantness of diplomacy when you have a quiet little armed force in the background. Which leads to the third and final lesson, which connects back even past our founding principles to the wisdom of the classical world. If you want peace, prepare for war. This is a lesson that Wisconsin's very own Mel Laird, who sadly passed away in 2016, knew all too well. After nine terms in Congress representing Wisconsin's 7th District, including as Republican conference chair, Laird served as Secretary of Defense during the Nixon administration at a key crossroads for American national security policy. When the Nixon administration entered office, the U.S. was in turmoil. Congress and even many in the administration were in no mood to invest heavily in national defense. Anticipating a drawdown in Vietnam, they hoped that we would be able to reap a small peace dividend and redirect defense dollars to social services. Yet, this desire for a peace dividend was coming at precisely the wrong time. While the Pentagon had understandably been focused on the war in Vietnam, by the early 1970s, the Soviets had all but attained strategic nuclear parity with the United States. Conventional parity threatened to follow, although the U.S. still had a slight lead in military technology. It was therefore essential that the United States counter the rapid increase in Soviet capabilities with a rigorous military modernization program. Unfortunately, wartime spending on operations in Southeast Asia had eaten into dollars needed for modernization and readiness, and if we were to stay ahead of the Soviets, something had to change. For Mel Laird, this meant threading an extraordinarily tight needle between the downward pressure under the defense budget demanded by Congress and the many demands of building up a robust post-Vietnam military. Vietnamization was the first step of this. And this allowed Laird to save money by shrinking the military by more than 1 million in just 4 years, while in the process transitioning to a professional all-volunteer force. The budgetary headroom bought by these cuts to military personnel allowed Laird to protect modernization even during an era of declining defense budgets. Many of the systems fielded or developed under Laird's tenure read as foundational components of the modern American arsenal. Later on, night vision, multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle missile payloads, sensors, laser-guided munitions, the Ohio-class ballistic missile submarine and its Trident missiles, and of course the B-1 bomber. As his frequent opponent in bureaucratic battles, Henry Kissinger later observed, "He preserved the sinews of our strength, and laid the basis for expansion when the public mood changed later. This was a major achievement. I quite like what Eisenhower said of Laird when Nixon told him he was going to be Secretary of Defense. He had earlier said Laird was too devious for the position, if you read in Peter Rodman's great book, President's Command. But he said, of course, Laird is devious, but for anyone who has to run the Pentagon and get along with Congress, that is a very valuable asset. The connection between military power and the preservation of peace permeates the framers' vision. In Federalist 41, Madison makes the case that since we cannot set the bounds on military power of other nations, we cannot safely limit our own military power. The framers also weren't just interested in territorial defense, however. They understood that American power projection would one day bring great benefits to the young republic. As Hamilton writes in Federalist 11, the necessity of naval protection to external or maritime commerce and the conduciveness of that species of commerce to the prosperity of a navy are points too manifest to require particular elucidation. They, by a kind of reaction mutually beneficial, promote each other. In other words, what the framers intuitively understood, and what La Follette, interestingly, at times did not, was not that only that weakness invites aggression, but also that a strong military generates additional benefits that both enhance both American diplomacy and economic interests. Of course, maintaining a strong military also means conserving its strength, avoiding the entitlement crisis infecting our ability to invest in lethality, and most importantly, not expending American lives and resources on dumb wars that we cannot win. I received a note from Mel Laird in the course of my campaign, which was amazing to me. It's one of my most treasured possessions now. And he said nice things about my campaign and was excited that there was someone interested in foreign policy running for Congress in Wisconsin. And he included an article, and it wasn't about his time as Secretary of Defense. It was about the role that he played in making sure the Packers survived when the NFL was negotiating its TV contract. This was a man who had his priorities straight, I have to tell you. But it is worth thinking about what allows a team, by far in the smallest city, to host a professional franchise, to be not only a perennial playoff contender, but the 10th most valuable franchise in the NFL. I have to tell you, and maybe I'm a little bit biased, it's because the community, at various points in its history, has risen up to demand that the team stay. It's because our community is strong. And I think ultimately that's the biggest lesson we're left with from the founders, that the strength of our country in many ways doesn't come from the size of our military or how cool the gadgets we carry downrange are, but from the strength of our individual communities. And that may not sound new. I know I've not said much new today, and I worry this will all seem blindingly obvious to this audience, but as George Orwell put it, to see what is in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. Fortunately, this is not the case in Wisconsin. This is still a place where common sense is a common virtue. Where we try to work hard and place our faith in ourselves, not the government, but all we ask in return is that the federal government do just a few things well that we can't do on our own. Foremost among these, particularly because we understand that we can't wall ourselves off from the world, is to provide for the common defense. In his travels across the young republic in 1831 and 1832, Green Bay, Wisconsin, my hometown, was the furthest northwest that Alexis de Tocqueville journeyed. About his time in Green Bay, after a series of adventures involving canoeing, swimming, shooting, and hiking, de Tocqueville records that he got lost for a moment and then returned to the place without realizing it. Wisconsin has a way of doing just that, helping those who are lost return to their point of departure without realizing it. And in reclaiming our founding principles and in finding a way forward on foreign policy in the present day, I would submit we could do much, much worse than that. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Congressman. I had no idea that Wisconsin had had so much impact on foreign policy. My question is, to the first portion of your remarks, you know, how do we convince or otherwise incentivize members of Congress to take back their authority with regard to these ongoing military engagements?
Sure.
You know, it seems like Congress has willingly allowed this to happen. So how is it that now members like yourself can convince others to take back their authority?
Sure. Great question. So I think the most obvious or the lowest hanging fruit, it's something I've been working on when I worked on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 2013, 2015, was to at least have a debate over the continued utility of the 9/11 AUMF, which I mentioned. I mean, which we're using, by the way, to kill people that weren't born when it was written. And I think we stretched it to its limits. And I think Congress, if it wants to be taken seriously, needs to have that debate. And it's my opinion that we should pass a new AUMF. Now, I don't want to see it laden with tactical restrictions. I could be convinced for it to have a time restriction or a sunset. But absent that, we're going to continue to put all these wars on autopilot, and they're going to expand to no end. The second and less sort of sexy suggestion is that it really boils down to doing in-depth oversight, which I fear is a skill in Congress that we've lost. On the Armed Services Committee, I would submit we do it better than most, but even that, things tend to sometimes be on autopilot, and the Pentagon has grown so big and massive that even if you're a defense specialist or a foreign policy specialist, which I was at one point, it can be hard, particularly amidst the constant demands of fundraising, to carve out enough time to do effective oversight. The third thing that I would be interesting to get this group's take on, and I've just started to dig into this and was having a debate with, I'm sure, a Federalist Society favorite, Mike Lee, last night. On trade, obviously we have the power to sort of regulate commerce with foreign nations, but I think if you look at the history, and correct me if I'm wrong, there have been a series of pieces of legislation passed whereby we've delegated our power on trade to the executive branch, and it actually was part of a trade liberalizing idea. The idea being that if you have 535 members of Congress adjudicating trade, you know, I would be aggressively arguing for dairy, you know, Ben Sass would be arguing for, what do they grow in Nebraska? I don't even know. More speeches about de Tocqueville is what Ben Sass would be arguing for. I love Ben Sass. But you'd have a more protectionist policy, whereas in the present day, we're seeing the opposite, and Congress seems pretty well neutered on trade. And even on treaties that we've approved, it's an open question as to whether we can disapprove it. I had an amendment on the NDAA that would basically allow us to abrogate the INF if it was found, as it has been found, that Russia's been in violation last three years. And this also, I mean, as treaties gets incorporated in domestic law, Congress has the ability to weigh in on it. There was a head money case. I had to look at my notes here because I was trying to figure out what you guys were going to say, and I'm not smart enough to do it extemporaneously, but I did prepare. Famously found that Congress could mandate fees from non-citizens at ports of entry into the U.S. regardless of any treaty obligation. So this is interesting. Cheney and I have this language in the House passed NDAA that would give the president a year to certify that Russia had returned to compliance with the treaty, and if the president cannot make this certification, INF limitations would no longer be binding as a matter of U.S. law. So I would love for you guys to debate that at some point and tell me whether it's constitutional.
Okay, very good. Right here, please.
I'm not going to take up that challenge, but you know, politics is the art of the possible. But put that aside, if you were the foreign policy and military czar, what would be your number one priority that you'd like to see for action?
That's a great question. So again, this is biased. I do believe, so it's an interesting question, right? I mean, there was a debate in our founding about standing armies, but navies were a different matter entirely. And indeed, there's a mandatory provision in the Constitution that says the Congress shall provide and maintain a navy. And so I'm a big believer in the 355-ship navy. I believe you sort of look at the world the best way that we can project power in an agile fashion and provide platforms for technology that we know is going to be more important, autonomous technology, robotics, UUVs, all sorts of things. It starts with the Navy. And if you look at what China's doing, they're investing massively in their Navy. They have the largest Navy in the Pacific, over 300 ships. Ours are more capable, but at some point, quantity has a quality all of its own. And for those who argue that the carrier is no longer relevant in a A2AD world where, you know, we have long-range missiles that can strike ships, how is it less relevant than bases we have in Japan, in Guam? Take your pick, right? Those bases can't pick up and move at 30 knots. Carriers can. And so I think the Navy actually buys us the most options over time and saves money over the long term. And it's going to require, and I say this being in a shipbuilding district, it's going to require urgency, right? If you look at the way in which we got to the 600-ship, near 600-ship Navy under Reagan, it required John Lehman with a consistent demand signal and support of the president to really bend the bureaucracy to his will. And right now, we're not doing that. And I fear we're missing a window. And we could wake up in 20 years, and the Chinese could totally outclass us in this stuff. So that's my little bias.
Okay, we're really short on time. Maybe one quick question, if we have one.
Chaz will pull me. We got to go. Is it going? Okay, maybe one more question. Yeah.
Just one more, sir, right here in the front.
Thank you, Edwin Williamson. And on the question of an AUMF, I have a theory that we will never have a legally necessary AUMF because the president has the inherent power to defend, the way I phrase it is defend vital national interests. Mm-hmm. And if he cannot make that argument that what the use of force is in defense of a vital national security interest, then he is not going to be able to convince Congress to pass one. So we're just not going to end up having one. Sure. That is other than as we had under the three that we had under the Bushes, is just a political endorsement of what the president is doing, which I think is essential, and I'd suggest any president do that. So I'm not sure, and then I think the further difficulty in having an AUMF, as you say, is that you don't want it bogged down in tactical decisions, and I honestly don't believe that you can get such a bill, such an AUMF through Congress in the absence of an argument that this is a defense of a vital national security.
Well, I certainly wouldn't make the argument that Congress isn't going to screw it up after being there for a year and a half. But I just find the present situation to be an absurdity, a constitutional absurdity, and doing long-term damage to our country. Also, by the way, I mean, as someone who did, you know, carry a rifle downrange, I tend to think that it enhances the efficacy of our military actions when, you know, men and women in uniform know that they have the clear support of the American people. So if nothing else, I feel like we have to have a debate. There has to be a way to thread that needle. We have, again, I think perhaps the best way is, while not dictating, you know, what sort of tools the military is allowed to use, you could have sort of a five-year sunset clause written to an AUMF, and at least you would give the skeptics some sense that it would be redebated every few years. But I do think we have to ask ourselves, because you mentioned vital interests. I don't know. There are experts in this room. I'm not one of them. I thought Madison's notes at the Constitutional Convention suggest the president only has the inherent ability to repel sudden attacks. I could be wrong. And the problem with vital interests, there's a lot of academic work done on this about defining the national interest. I mean, you can really make a case that it means anything you want it to mean at the end of the day. Do we have a vital interest in enforcing the norm against the use of chemical weapons? That's up for debate. I don't know. Do we have a vital interest in preventing terrorist safe haven in Afghanistan, which strikes me as perhaps the best argument for continuing to be there, given that we should all have serious doubts about our South Asia strategy right now? I don't know. What have 17 years of arguing that we need to prevent safe haven done for U.S. foreign policy? I think we need to revisit this assumptions. My hope is that the debate would allow us to have these conversations, which we're not having. Two fundamental perversions, I think, of Congress over the last few decades. The first start in the 70s. There was a period of productive reform actually led by La Follette's son, Bobby La Follette, in the 40s, 46, there was a commission set up. But then there was a series of reforms that were ironically intended to claw back power from the executive branch to Congress, budgetary reforms, and then, of course, the War Powers Resolution, which had precisely the opposite effect. So over time, the trend has been Congress growing increasingly irrelevant. But then in the 90s, what's happened in Congress is that power has gone from the committees of jurisdiction, which would be predisposed to do something like you're talking about, and has been tightly concentrated in leadership in both parties. Gingrich started it, Pelosi continued it, and this is where we are today. So even if you want to do something like this, oftentimes leadership blocks the debate because they don't think it's politically expedient to have it right now. And I talked to my colleagues who've been there a lot longer than I have, and they'll say there used to be a day when, in some ways, your allegiance as a member of the committee outweighed your allegiance to your party or to the caucus because you were engaged on these issues and you sort of knew what you were talking about. So
Congressman, we'll have to continue the conversation at a later date, but we thank you very much for your time and for your remarks.
Well, the only problem with Congress is you have to vote sometimes, so I apologize. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.